Okay, we have two readings this week. One is we have the regular weekly portion. And on top of that, we have one of the four special parshios, which is called Parshas Parah. So if we're lucky, we'll be able to try to get to both of them. One of the most traumatic episodes in the entire Chumash takes place this week. And that episode is the episode of the golden calf. And we can be right now thousands of years in the future. And we have a very hard time, maybe especially being far in the future, we have a hard time understanding what it is that we're reading. And part of our difficulty is because the verses themselves are not all that clear. The Torah says in the beginning of chapter 32, Perek Lamed Beis, Vayar ha'am ki boshesh Moshe l'redes min ahar. The people saw that Moshe was delayed in coming down from the mountain. Vayikahel ha'am al aharon. The people gathered on Aaron. Vayomri lo, and they say to him, Kum ase lanu Elohim. Make for us a god, or make for us a deity. The name they use is the name Elohim. Asher yelchu lefaneinu, who will walk in front of us, ki ze Moshe ha'ish, asher lonu me'eretz Yitzrayim, lo yodanu mehayalo. For Moshe, the man who took us out of Egypt, we don't know what happened to him. So it's very, very clear that they want to replace Moshe, and the Moshe who they want to replace, they clearly know is a man. I'm not going to talk about it today, but maybe that was their mistake. Maybe their mistake was thinking that Moshe was only a man. Moshe was a regular man. And if they would have realized who Moshe really was, then maybe they never would have made this mistake. And I mean that. I'll say this on a very, very simple level right now, but there's a lot more to talk about this. Maybe if they would have realized that Moshe has the ability of being up for 40 days and 40 nights without eating anything. Again, that's not a normal thing. The Gemara says, how do you know, or the Midrash says, how do you know you're supposed to follow, you know, when in Rome, how do you know you're supposed to follow local custom? Because it says when the angels came to visit Avraham, what do? They ate. But when Moshe goes to heaven to get the Torah, what does he do? He doesn't eat. So it teaches you that you should follow local custom. But how can a person, again, how can a person go to heaven? How can a person go up and come down? How can a person be there 40 days and 40 nights? So they stress over here saying, Moshe the man, we don't know what happened to him. So I'm saying that may be part of their mistake. Part of the mistake is underestimating Moshe. Let me make another observation. And this observation is just to bother you a little bit. When we look at people in antiquity, especially when it comes to issues of idolatry, but it's other issues as well, we tend to look at their behavior in a literal way, which means we don't make an allowance for them to think symbolically. We look at them acting and thinking very literally. Let me ask you all a question. Have any of you ever either been to or seen a football game, college football game, professional football game? Yes, no, never? Yes, you have. San Diego Chargers. I didn't ask you which one. Can you imagine a sociologist or anthropologist finding old footage 1,000 years from now? And coming to all kinds of interesting conclusions. And to say there was one city that worshipped the rams, another city that worshipped the buffaloes, or whatever, or the lions, or whatever it was. And they would then give a very literal interpretation of it. And all of us sitting here would say, well, you don't get it. It wasn't literal. There was something symbolic involved with that. But yet, when we look at people who lived a long time ago, we judge them as if what they're doing or they're looking or they're expressing is totally literal, and we don't make an allowance for any type of a symbolic understanding. So I'm just saying, please appreciate that, because there was probably far more symbolic thinking within idolatry than any of us give them credit for. If you want to get a bit deeper on that level, and why the attraction to a calf of all things. One of the things that happened when they passed through the sea, we're told by the commentaries, is that they had an incredible religious, mystical experience. So much so that when they sing the song afterwards, what do they say? They say, Ze keli va'anvehu. Rashi says, they point a finger. They say, that is my God, and I will cherish him. What do they see? So, if you trace back the commentaries and go back to the Mechilta, and there's two different Mechiltas, Mechilta of Rabbi Shmuel, Mechilta of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, it says they saw more than the prophets saw. Which prophets? So one says Yeshayahu, one says Yecheskel. The Mechilta of Rashbi says more than Yecheskel. What did Yecheskel say? So there's this incredible prophecy of Yecheskel, of Ezekiel. I invite you to look at the first chapter, look at the 10th chapter. He tells us that he was by the river Kfar. I'll be nice to you today. I'll explain to you a little bit of this. No, you're not supposed to understand it. It says in the beginning of the book Ezekiel, Vayehi b'shloshim shana, in the 30th year, b'rivi, b'chamisha l'chodesh, the 4th month, the 5th of the month, va'ani b'toch hagola, or va'ani b'soch hagola, and I am among the exiles. Al nahar kfar, by the river called the river Kfar. Do you want me to explain this to you or no?
Yeah.
You have a hesitation? Do you have a hesitation? You want me to explain this or not? I'm asking you a question.
If you want to,
do you have a hesitation or?
Not anymore.
Vani b'soch hagola, that I was among the exiles, al nahar kfar, by the river called Kfar. Niftachu ha-shamayim, the heavens opened up, ve'ere maros elokim, and I saw visions of God. Again, the visions that he sees, is, it says elokim, not yudke vavke. Not the eternal, but rather the aspect of God that they think they can understand. In the third verse, it says, Hayo haya dvar Hashem, behold, the word of God was on El Yecheskel ben Buzi HaKohen, was on Yecheskel. Now, something very interesting just now happened. The first verse says, I was among the exiles. The third verse says, and God spoke to Yecheskel, which means we have a shift from first person to third person. This shift is part of the key to understanding the mystical experience and is actually the key to the beginning of mystical experience. I will explain a little bit more. Moshe was the greatest prophet who ever lived. We're also told that Moshe was the most modest man who ever lived. That's not a coincidence. It's Moshe's... Excuse me? There's a very silly man who made a lot of money. His name is Richard Elliot Friedman. He wrote a book, who wrote the Bible. And in his introduction he says that the Jews believe that Moshe wrote the Bible. Moshe wrote the Torah. And if Moshe wrote the Torah, then Moshe wrote that he was the most modest man. Then how can the most modest man, he write he was the most modest man? So obviously we need to find a different conclusion, who wrote the Bible. Now you know why that's silly? Because the Jews don't claim that Moshe wrote it. God wrote it. Which means God can say to Moshe, pick up the quill, he picks up the quill. Start to write. Umosha, he writes Umosha. Haya, he writes Haya. Right? Anav mikol Adam. And Moshe turns red, and he looks at whatever he looks at, and he says to God, come on, okay, you have to be kidding. And God says, write. And Moshe says, how can I write this? It's not true. And God says, it's on me. Which means what he did is he says, let me deal with the Jewish perspective. The Jewish perspective is that Moshe is the author. And with that sentence, he gets rid of the Jewish perspective. Is that amazing to you? It's not amazing to you. It's amazing to me that he can write this book, and therefore the Orthodox perspective was dealt with in one sentence. Because if Moshe couldn't have written it for that reason. Which means at least be honest as to what the Orthodox perspective is. The Orthodox perspective is that God is the author. Moshe is not the author. As a matter of fact, the Orthodox perspective is if you claim that Moshe is the author, that's heresy. So anyway, Moshe was the most modest man. Moshe was the greatest prophet. Why was Moshe the greatest prophet? Because he was the most modest man. Which means, what is it that prevents us from experiencing spirituality? And that is being self-absorbed, being self-involved. Which means, just think for a second. There may be all kinds of, you know, if you want to call them like radio waves, spiritual waves which are out there, but our antennae are not up because we're too busy doing other things. We're self-involved instead of opening up to what's outside of us. That's an amazing thought, that God may be trying to communicate to us, but we can't take it in because we're too busy. The shift over here from first person to third person actually tells us how to prepare for a spiritual experience. What's the first step? Va'ani b'toch ha'gola. What does that mean? That the I has to go into exile. The I, the self-involvement, needs to be exiled. You have to throw away the self-involvement. And what happens then? Then you end up in this third person that God speaks to Yechezkel. But what's the preparation for God speaking to Yechezkel? When he sends the ego off into exile. Any of that make sense? This is known as the Ma'aseh Merkava. That's what you're referring to, that you can't. It never calls it Ma'aseh Merkava all the way through. The Ma'aseh Merkava literally means the act of the chariot. The chariot, which he's about to see and tell us about, is a spiritual elevator. It's an elevator that can take you up into heaven. It's an elevator that can take you up and let you see what's going on in heaven. But in order to go up the elevator, you need to realize that you are not the center of the universe, and God is the center of the universe. In fact, the word Merkava comes from the word, the root of it is the word Rachav, or Rechev, which is spelled Resh Kaf Bet. Rachav. The river that he was standing by was a river which is called the river Kfar, which is spelled Kaf Bet Resh. What he's going to see very soon is he's going to see a kruv. A kruv is a cherub. And a kruv is spelt kaf, resh, bet. All of these are the same letters. And by the way, in terms of gematria, obviously it will be an identical gematria, which is 222. A bet is the second of the single digits. A 20 is the second of the tens, right? That's a kaf. And a resh is the second of the hundreds, if any of you know gematria, which means the key to the mystical experience is using the two, number two. But most of us use number one. Most of us think that we are primary. It's only when we realize that we are secondary can we possibly understand more about God, which is primary. So therefore, the vehicle over here is the Merkava, which is made out of two. The place that it takes place over here is this river called Kfar, which indicates number two, and the kruv that he sees, the cherub that he sees, also represents this thing which is secondary, but not a manifestation of God itself, but some kind of angel or some kind of cherub or some kind of vision. By the way, he tells us that he sees this chariot with four sides and four faces. If you compare the first chapter and the tenth chapter, you will find that in the first chapter he says one of the four faces was the face of a kruv, and in the tenth chapter the same face he describes as the face of an ox, which means, at least from his perspective, the kruv looks somewhat ox-like. And by the way, the foot that he sees coming out is the foot of an egel, the foot of a calf, which means the perspective of looking at this chariot is the perspective of seeing something ox-like along the way. And if everything I'm saying to you now sounds very, very strange, I can assure you that this is in the Ramban's commentary to explain part of what the mistake was in terms of the golden calf. Because part of the revelation that they had was a revelation of a chariot. But what's the problem if you have an incredible revelation and you're not ready to see it? You're not spiritually sophisticated enough to see it. you may look at it in terms of a literal sense instead of understanding the symbolism involved in it. And if you don't understand the symbolism, you are going to jump off to the symbolism, which means you're going to go after the wrapping without understanding what's inside. You're going to go after the superficial part without going into the essence. That's all I'm going to explain about this right now in terms of the chariot. Is that okay? We didn't break anything?
First chapter, this is in the 10th chapter.
Yes, you'll look, you have your homework.
Yeah.
Now, the people say that Moshe the man isn't here, but in fact they use another word, and if you understand the word that they use, you will then understand the key to the whole tragedy that takes place. They say, Moshe the man who, back in chapter 32, the end of verse 1, Moshe the man who took us out of Egypt, lo yadanu mehayolo. We don't know what happened to him. So, you know, every question or every problem has a premise to it. Very often when people ask a question, the first thing that I have to do is to try to identify the premise. Because if there's a mistake in the premise, there will be a mistake in the question. Wrong thinking is more often than not is caused by a faulty premise. What's the faulty premise which exists in this verse? It says, Moshe the man, we don't know what happened to him. So what is their premise? That they have a right to know. They have a capability of knowing. They should know. Which means the sin over here over the golden calf is caused by the people assuming that they can know that which they can't know. This does connect back to what happened when the sea was split. Because when the sea was split, and they think they see God, they have a revelation, and they point their hands and say, Zeh Keli Vanvehu. There is God, and I will cherish him. The problem of having a revelation, the problem of seeing something which is divine, or has something of the divine to it, is that it could be addictive. It's not this kind of experience that you have at one time in your life and say, okay, that was good. It's the kind of thing that once it happens once, you want it again and again and again. Moshe's not there. They're searching, they're thirsty, they want something. But what is the problem? The problem is based upon knowledge. Now, I want to read to you. We already did the Masa Merkava today, so let me read to you a passage which is in the Zohar. Because it explains what went wrong. Excuse me?
Are we ready for this?
You're not. You won't understand it. It's fine. I'm not reading from the Zohar. It's fine.
Great.
The Zohar tells us, those of you who don't know what the Zohar is a mystical commentary to the Torah. This is Zohar on Bereshis and on Shmos and Vayikra and Midrash Devarim. I'm reading from you from almost the first page of Bereshis, the very beginning. The main protagonist of the Zohar is a man known as Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. He was a student of Rabbi Akiva. The Zohar then became an oral tradition which was passed on to his students. It's not clear exactly when it was written even, because Rav Shimon Bar Yochai's death is recorded within the Zohar. And his students and student students have this tradition of the Zohar, and it was a secret mystical tradition for many, many years. We're told that one day Eliyahu the prophet came and visited Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. Rav Shimon Bar Yochai was walking along the river, by the seashore. The sea is called in Hebrew the Yam. He was walking by the Yam, by the sea. And Eliyahu Hanavi comes to him and questions him regarding a verse in Yeshayahu chapter 40. The verse says, Se'u marom einechem, ure'u mi bara ele. Lift your eyes heavenward. By the way, the first three letters of Se'u marom einechem is Shin Mem Ayin, which spells Shema. When you say Shema, what you're doing is you're lifting your eyes heavenward. Se'u marom einechem, lift your eyes towards heaven, ure'u, and see who created all of these, who created all of this. So Eliyahu Navi comes and he sees Rav Shimon taking a walk, a stroll on the beach, and he says, Rebbe, What does this verse mean? And Shimon ben Yochai, who was a great sage, says to Eliyahu Navi, to Elijah the prophet, who, by the way, how did he go up into heaven? How does his life end? He goes up in a chariot up into heaven. So he's really talking, if you understand this, of the chariot, of how to get up to heaven, how do you lift your eyes towards heaven. And he says, what does this verse mean? So Shimon ben Yochai says that this verse, who created all of these, mi bara elah, who created all this, that this refers to God who created all of this. So therefore, what does the verse mean? Lift your eyes to heaven, appreciate that there is a God, and God created all of this. And Eliyahu HaNavi sort of says to him, that's very nice, but would you like to know what God taught in the yeshiva shamala, in the Masifta Derekiya? Up in heaven, God has a yeshiva. And God is the Rosh Yeshiva. And in this yeshiva, God gives lessons. So Eliyahu says, would you like to know what God taught about this verse? Should I continue? So he obviously says, sure. I'll read it to you, but it's okay if you don't understand it. I'll explain a little bit. But first I'll read. Then he said to me, Master, the Holy and Blessed Be He has a deep secret which he revealed at length in the heavenly economy. It is this. With the most mysterious wish to reveal himself, he produced a single point which was transmuted into a thought, and in this he executed numeral designs and engraved innumerable engravings. He further engraved within the sacred and mystic lamp a mystic and most holy design, which was a wondrous edifice issuing from the midst of thought. Okay, let me explain. Imagine that for some reason you want to shave, and you have an electric shaver, but there's no batteries in it, so you have to plug it in. Would you want to plug that in directly into a nuclear reactor? The answer, by the way, if you're not sure, is no. Because what's the worst case scenario? A nuclear accident, right? Which means you have enormous power and you have limited capability of using or utilizing that enormous power, which means you need this energy somehow to be downgraded until the point that you can actually plug into it. You have God, which is this power beyond our imagination, and somehow this power is going to become accessible to us. Now, how does that process take place? What needs to happen for that to happen? Now at this point, even before the chariot, at this point, please realize something. There's no words. There's no language. There's no letters. You can't describe God because the words just don't even exist to describe God. And by the way, part of the problem of idolatry is that we try to represent God, but the reality of God can't be represented because the reality of God is so transcendent, is so beyond, that there's nothing that can possibly represent it. Which means the problem of idolatry is that almost anything that you do to represent God is going to be false. And by the way, the same is true in terms of words. Almost anything that you say about God. What's the best way to complete the sentence? God is?
Everything.
Period is the best way to complete the sentence. Because anything else that you say, you're going to end up getting yourself into some kind of trouble. Because I'm saying even words are difficult. Over here, what he's saying is that God was going to reveal himself. God was going to create. He produced a single point which was transmuted into thought, which means you're not even at the point of the thought of God. It's something so much higher that God has to produce something in our language which is called thought. And in this thought, he made all kinds of designs and engravings and so on, which is really the potential of everything that will then come out of it. Which is a wondrous edifice issuing from the midst of thought. That the thought is now going to somehow flow into reality, or what we call reality. Because what's really reality? Really reality is God. But we live in this other reality, we think that this is reality. Maybe I'll talk about that next week. This thing that he created is called me. Mem Yud. What is me? What does the word me mean? Who? Who, by the way, has a question mark at the end? Me. With a question mark. Me. Who? And was the beginning of the edifice, existent and non-existent. What does it mean, existent and non-existent? Because reality is that God is completely transcendent. But on the other hand, God created this, so it exists. But it exists and it doesn't exist. It exists from our perspective, but from God's perspective, it's something which really doesn't exist. Are you with me still? deep buried, unknowable by name. Why is it unknowable by name? Because names themselves are things which are somewhat... It's the covering. A name is the covering. It's not the essence. It is only called me. It desired to be manifest and called by name. It therefore clothed itself in a refulgent and precious garment and created Ele, and created these. And Ele acquired a name. So you have me, which is a question mark, which is unknowable. Who? Question mark. And Ele. Where does Ele, all of this, come from? All of creation, where does it come from? It comes from God. Can you really know God? No, that's the point. You really can't know God. The letters of these two words intermingled, forming the complete name, Ele and me, came together. And what name did it create? Elohim. God. Which means the first verse in the Torah, Bereshis bara Elohim, in the beginning God created. To even get to that verse, there's so much, shall we say, a downward transformers that were used in order to get to that verse from the infinite God, where words and language doesn't even work, to get to that point of creation. So we read that verse, Bereshis bara Elohim, the beginning that God created. What verse were they speaking about here? Mi bara Ele. So Mi bara Ele is the Mi and the Ele. Mi bara Ele, which means who created these, the Mi and the Ele come together. And once they come together, how do you answer the question of where the universe came from? What is the correct answer? Bereshis bara Elohim. In the beginning, God created. But of course, what do we now recognize? That before that beginning, there was something else which our minds can't understand, because you don't even understand the words of English that I just now read to you. Right? Can you imagine I read this to you in the real Aramaic over here? You would have no clue what I'm talking about. So it could be, of everything I just now said in the last 15 minutes, maybe all together, you guys got 30% of it. Am I being mean? Okay. I just want to make sure we understand one another. Once the me and the Ela come together, but what are the me and Ela made from? It's made from a question mark. The question mark is where things come from, because it's God. We don't have words for it. We can't represent it. And the Ela is all of this. Once the me and the Ela emerge, what happens? The only reality now is Bereshis bara Elohim. Don't try to go before that. And don't try to represent God, because you can't. Now, what was the sin of the golden calf? He continues and he says, when the Israelites sinned in making the golden calf, they alluded to this mystery in saying, when they made the calf, you know what they said? Ele Elohecha Yisrael. There is your God. So they had the Ele, but what was missing now? The me. What was missing? The question mark. What was missing? Who? What was the answer? Elohim. But they tried to take away Elohim. They took away the me. And by the way, just in case you're worried, why is the me inverted there? Where was he standing? He was standing by the yam. He was standing by the sea, which is the me inverted. That's where this revelation takes place. Standing by the yam, he has this revelation, and he's told that was the sin of the golden calf. Namely, the Jews tried to understand that which they couldn't understand. They wanted to say, Elo Elohecha Yisrael. They wanted to point the finger at God, and I'll say parenthetically, like they were able to do when the sea was split. Again, when they were by the sea, by the Yam, they were able to then say, Elo Elohecha Yisrael. Sorry, they were able to say, Zeh Keli Vanvehu. But over here, they wanted to be able to point the finger, and that was the sin. Trying to understand that which they couldn't understand. And where should our starting point be instead? Bereshis bara Elohim. By the way that this, when Rav Shimon B'Yochai taught this to his son and to his students, it obviously went over better than it just now went over when I taught it to you. Because it says over here, Elio then flew away, he went back up into heaven, vanished from my sight. It is from him that I became possessed of this profound mystery. Rabbi Eliezer and all his companions came and bowed down in front of him, weeping for joy. And they said, if we had come into this world only to hear this, we would have been content. If in our whole lives this is the only piece of Torah we ever learned, we would have been happy. And look at you guys. Okay. Anyway.
We're great.
This sin of trying to understand that which you can't understand actually has its roots all the way back in the Garden of Eden. And that's the Eitz Hadas. The Eitz Hadas is the tree of knowledge. God says you can eat from all the trees of the garden except for this one tree. What's the tree? The tree of knowledge. And by the way, maybe every generation is the case, but I just have a feeling this is more so our generation, that this tree of knowledge haunts us. First, let me say something else. Why should knowledge be bad? What's the matter with knowledge? Oh, you know the answer, okay.
I was going to say you have more responsibility.
Before you get that, we need to define what knowledge is. It could be. It could be. You're absolutely correct here.
Knowledge without wisdom is dangerous.
Knowledge without wisdom is, and therefore we also need a definition. Yeah.
Wrong knowledge is dangerous.
Okay. Correct. First of all, I lied to you. It wasn't a tree of knowledge. What was it?
No.
A tree of knowledge of good and evil.
Right.
There's a difference. And what's the problem of eating from the tree of knowledge of good and evil? You now have ingested good and evil. And now good and evil are confused. That's a problem. Okay, that's point number one. But it's not a tree of wisdom. Right? It's not a tree of wisdom, it's a tree of knowledge. Knowledge is closely connected to experience. Right after they leave the Garden of Eden, what does it say? Right after this, right after they eat from the tree, what does it say? Vayoda Adam eschava ishto. Adam knew his wife Eve. And that's where it comes, he knew her in the biblical sense. But what does it mean? They experienced one another. Which means experience, and that's the problem with this generation. We're a generation that needs to learn from experience. But the problem with experience, without wisdom, is that it could be very, very dangerous. The Jews are waiting by the bottom of the mountain. They're waiting for Moshe to come down with the greatest wisdom ever. I'm understating that point right now. Can you imagine this? They're waiting for Moshe to come down with wisdom. But what do they choose instead? They choose to reject Moshe because it's very frustrating because he's a man. And men are here today and gone tomorrow and men are fickle. And let's replace Moshe with a god. Moshe Ha'ish. Moshe, the man who took us out, we replace him with a god. But what kind of god? A god who's going to somehow represent God. And that's this whole thing that I tried to tell you before in terms of the Kruvim and in terms of the chariot and in terms of seeing something. But the problem was it was one of arrogance because they're going to try to create a God that they can understand because they think they have the right to understand. Because Moshe, the man, we don't know what happened to him. Yada, we don't know. Knowledge. So they think they can know which they can't. They think they can know that which they shouldn't know. And that goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden. Again, what do they choose? Think for a second. All of you who have been raised on television and movies, I want you to consider the following split screen. Moshe in heaven receiving the final touches where God is chiseling that last little, you know, chisel, about to give him the tablets. That scene, what kind of colors do you have in the background? What kind of music do you have playing?
Awesome. Very pure.
Very pure. You got violins there? Very, very pure. No, I want, get serious. I want you to think about this. You have this pure scene up in heaven, and at the same time, one second, we'll come back to you in a second with whatever you're playing there. At the same time, you have a split screen, and the people are down below who've created a God. They're going for experience instead of wisdom. They've created a God, and they're dancing around it. Most of them already disrobed already. There's this, you know, loud drum beat going on over here. They're having a body experience. And then you split the screen again, and you see what's going on in heaven. And they're choosing experience. They're choosing a rave over Moshe about to come down with the Torah. Do you get what I'm saying? Am I being clear enough? Or not yet? Because they want experience. They want to feel it. They want to feel it with their bodies. That's knowledge. That's what it means by knowledge. Now, let me go back for one more step to this tree of knowledge. What's the problem with the tree of knowledge? It's not really a tree of knowledge. What is it? A tree of knowledge of good and evil. It's a tree of knowledge of good and evil. A lot of the good and a lot of the evil can be utilized. The good and the evil can be utilized, but what do you need? You need wisdom to know what the proper context is. You need wisdom to know when it is you're supposed to take off your clothes. And by the way, a hint, not in public in front of a golden calf. Okay? They need wisdom to know how they should be utilizing the power, but instead they go straight for the experience. Now there's one more thing about this tree. Do you remember there were two special trees in the garden? One was called the tree of life. And therefore, what's the other tree? This is not hard. The tree of death. So what's the reality? The other tree is the tree of death. Now, if you realize this, you have to say to yourself, why in the world would anybody ever choose the tree of death instead of the tree of life? By the way, the Jewish response would have been, first you eat from the tree of life, and then you go for the tree of death and you see what happens. Which, by the way, would be pretty silly. Because if it says death on it, right, you, what's that, like the skull and whatever and the cross, right? But exactly. It says, this package can cause death, but what do? You know, can I have two, please? Right? Can you close this, please? By the way, that means it's Shkia. Thanks. They're the same Shia as with Moshe Feinstein in terms of Shkia. But they choose, you with me still? You have the tree of life, and the tree of death. They choose the tree of death. Where does death come from? Trying to understand that which you can't understand. And death comes into the world. Okay. We're very good now. We have another opportunity to choose life, to choose wisdom, or to choose death. What do the people do? They choose knowledge and choose death at the foot of Mount Sinai. Same mistake all over again. So remember I told you there was another parasha that we get to read on Shabbos? It's called Parshas Parah. Now, in the very beginning, Parshas Parah is Zosi Chukas HaTorah. This is the Chok of the Torah. This is the definitive Chok. You know what a Chok is? There are certain commandments that we could have figured out by ourselves. For example, if I put all of you in a room by yourself and say, give me 10 commandments, I'm not saying that you know the 10 commandments right now, but I'm saying make up laws that you think make sense, you're going to write things like don't steal and don't kill and don't commit adultery. There are all kinds of things that you'll get because they're commandments that make sense. There are certain commandments that you never could have come up with yourself. I don't care how long you sit in a room by yourself. None of you can say, listen, I think the wool and linen thing, I think this is like really hot. Like, no one's going to come up with certain ones. This idea of the Parah Aduma is considered to be in rabbinic literature one of the most difficult chukim, a law which you would never come up by yourself. By the way, it doesn't mean that afterwards you can't find some kind of explanation. Nonetheless, Rashi tells us that when it comes to the Parah Aduma, when it comes to this particular chok, there is no reason for it. And Rashi writes even more than that. He says, "Ein lecha rishus laharechra." You have no permission to try to figure it out. Right? 22 verses later, at the end of the portion about the Parah Aduma, Rashi comes back and he says, "I'll explain the Parah Aduma to you." He just says, "You can't." Now he's explaining it. He says, it's sort of like, if there is a king who lives in a palace and he has a servant, and the servant's son makes a mess all over the palace, the king then would say to the servant, clean up the mess that your kid made. So he says that's the Parah Aduma comes to clean up the mess of the ego. Because a parah is a cow and an ego is a calf. So he says, okay, that's the reason. Now first of all, Rashi contradicts himself. The Rashi said there's no reason. 22 verses later, it's not like he forgot. It's not like he could say that he wrote it. No, 22 verses later, he quotes an opinion and he gives you the reason for it. He gives you the symbolism. The symbolism is that this red heifer comes to fix the golden calf. But how does this work? So I will explain to you how this works. What was the sin of the golden calf? Of trying to understand that which they can't understand. What was the sin in the Garden of Eden, eating from the tree of knowledge, which was the same sin? It was trying to understand that which they couldn't understand. What happens when they eat from the tree of knowledge? Death comes into the world. What is the red heifer used for? It's used when somebody comes in contact with death, you sprinkle them with this, which means that the red heifer is the antidote to death. But how is the antidote to death? What's the answer? The answer is because we don't understand it. Which means when you accept something because you don't understand it, and you don't try to understand that which you can't understand, then it becomes the way to heal the sin of the golden calf. Because the sin of the golden calf was trying to understand that which couldn't be understood.
Do you understand?
Mm-hmm. Very cool.
No?
I do understand, but I don't know if that's the right answer.
Correct. Correct.
Sure, it's not the right answer.
By the way, if we just ended Purim, and some of you, the way that you look, it looks like you're still suffering.
It's a holy hangover.
It's a holy hangover. It's interesting that on Purim, what do we say? We say, Mischayev Inish Levsume, a person is obligated to become intoxicated with drink, Ad Delo Yada, till he doesn't know. Which means until he's no longer, you're still singing, till he's no longer, Ad Delo Yada, till he's no longer affected by this thing of knowledge, Ad Delo Yada, in Urhon Baruch Mordechai. Which means he's no longer confused by the difference between good and evil. Ad Delo Yada, in Urhon Baruch Mordechai. Which is the sin that took place where the serpent tries to seduce us. And by the way, don't make no mistake about it. The Zohar says that the fruit of the golden calf, the fruit of the tree of knowledge, was grapes. Grapes is what's going to get you confused between good and evil. And the idea of Purim is drinking to the point that you know that you don't know. It's getting to this point of purity where everything is clear. And you're no longer trying to understand that which you can't understand. Which means when you drink and you say, no, I don't know the difference anymore, at that point you got to this clarity because you don't want to know anymore. At that point you no longer want to be affected. I don't know if any of you have any idea what I'm talking about, but if you look in the Sfas Emes, he says it. Whether he wrote it on Purim or not, that I can't tell you. But he did say that. And that's the core. The core over here is that man has an insatiable desire for knowledge. But what we need to do, and this is a very subtle shift, we need to shift that into an insatiable thirst for wisdom. This is the difference between wisdom versus knowledge. Knowledge is when you try to learn something via experience. Wisdom is when you try to understand something. Wisdom, try to understand it based upon theory. Wisdom is what Torah is. And once you possess the wisdom, then you're able to approach knowledge as well. Then you're able to approach experience. And I'm telling you, that's the sin of our generation. Our generation doesn't trust their wisdom. Our generation is not interested in wisdom. Our generation is running after all kinds of experiences. And once you have those experiences, you will take whatever wisdom you receive and you're going to twist it to fit into your experiences. Which means all the way back by the Garden of Eden, after they have this sin, then what happens? Two kruvim guard the path to the tree of life. And what we need to do is to do the opposite. We need to approach things with humility. We need to understand there's limits of what we can understand. We need to try to get wisdom. Wisdom is what God gave us. God gave us a Torah. If this comes from God, that means there's no greater wisdom in the world. We need to understand that we are not primary, we are secondary. If we understand that we are secondary, then we can get past those kruvim, because that's what the kruvim are. The kruvim come from the word karov. Again, kaf, resh, bet, which is two. And once you understand that, then you're able to access this river, which is called Kvar, then you're able to access this chariot, which is called the Merkava. But all of this comes from this point of humility, to understand that you are secondary, and there's a God which gives us the Torah. So the whole shift that needs to take place is for man to say, it's not knowledge that I seek, it's wisdom that I seek, it is not experience that I seek, it's Torah that I seek. And once I receive the Torah, then I can understand context and how to have all the experiences in the world. But then those experiences are no longer a confusion of good and evil. Then I'm able to separate good and evil. It's that confusion that brings death. But what is it that solves that? What is the antidote? That's the Parah Aduma. Why? Because we don't understand it. Why? Because we accept it despite not understanding it. And therefore, it's so appropriate that this week that we read together, on the one hand, the sin of the golden calf, but on the other hand, we read the antidote, and that is the Parah Aduma. Have a good Shabbos.
It's scary that the first time I might actually understand something.